You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and today for Leonard Lopate. African-American men are frequently the victims of police brutality that gets reported in the media, but other people of color go through discrimination that rarely gets covered. In Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color, police misconduct attorney Andrea J. Ritchie, writes about gender and race-based violence that happens to women and girls who are pregnant, transgender, disabled, or lesbian, in cases that include, and these are names you all know, Sandra Bland, Dejeria Becton, and Shakara Murphy. The book is published by Beacon Press, and I'm pleased it has brought Andrea Ritchie on our show today. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I got to talk about the cover of your book. There's a woman, it must be winter because she's wearing gloves, and she's got a hood on, and she's carrying a sign, and it says, "Black women, girls, and trans folks get locked up and shot too." Do you know who this person is on the cover?
Yeah, she's a dear comrade, Janae Bonsu. She's the policy director, the national policy director at Black Youth Project 100. And that's an organization, and she has been among its leaders that has really worked hard to center the experiences of Black women, girls, trans folks, and femmes in the conversation around racial profiling and police violence. So it was only fitting to have her on the cover representing that critical work.
Mm-hmm. And also it's fitting that she's on the cover because often these protests against police brutality are led by women. Women are the face of those protests and of that movement. Why is that?
Well, I think that one thing I want to acknowledge is that today is the third anniversary of the killing of Mike Brown by Officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson. And as you'll see from Whose Streets, I think, which is coming out in a couple days, Black women and girls and trans and gender nonconforming folks were on the front lines of Ferguson from the moment Mike Brown was shot down, and have, through their work, really transformed our responses, our protest movements around police violence and around state violence in ways that I think will shift how we understand those issues forever, because they were saying, we are here in the streets for Mike Brown, but we are also here in the streets for ourselves, and we will no longer be just the faces of protest without our stories being at the center of it. And I just really want to honor and lift up that shift in resistance that happened in that moment that had been unprecedented in some ways.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, there seems to be a sense that from you that a lot of these stories aren't told, that they're not reported, even though I think a lot of listeners might find that surprising, given all of the stories that we've heard. You mentioned one, the killing of Mike Brown. Here in New York and around the country, we were horrified by the video of Eric Garner and his last words. The horrifying video of Philando Castile. I can obviously go on and on and on. And yet, even though we know those stories, there are a lot more that don't get reported.
Or don't take a central role in our understanding of racial profiling or police violence. So, for instance, while today is the anniversary of Mike Brown's killing, Monday is the anniversary of police killing a Black woman named Michelle Cousseau in Phoenix, Arizona. Her family organized, her mother has been a tireless advocate and organized tremendous protests around her killing. Similarly, 3 months from now will be the anniversary of the killing of Tanisha Anderson in Cleveland and Aura Rosser during a domestic violence call in Ann Arbor. In each of those cases, people in those communities organized and their family members organized protests and demanded attention to those cases, but they did not become central and iconic in our movements of resistance in the same ways. And so kind of the lesson of this book is that all of these Black lives matter, and all of them have something to teach us about racial profiling and police violence, and all of them must be at the center of our resistance.
So talk more about that case in Arizona, because I've not, Michelle Cousseau, you said?
Yes, Michelle Cousseau was a Black lesbian who was living with a mental disability, had been labeled with a mental illness. She had stopped taking her medication. Her mother called the police to help get her into treatment again. And instead of showing up in a way that was supportive of her and helpful in getting her back into treatment, the responding officers, who ironically, sadly, had been trained in responding to mental health crises, shot and killed her when they first tried to break down her door, and then later came back and she had brought out a hammer to try and repair the damage to her door. And when they saw her standing at her door of her own apartment holding a hammer, the police officer shot her dead and later said, "There was something about the look in her eye that made me feel like I was in danger." And so that is something that is very reminiscent of what Darren Wilson said about Mike Brown, mm-hmm. what officers say over and over again about Black people. Yet her story and the context in which it happened is not a lens through which we understand these issues, and we need to.
And then you mentioned a case in Cleveland. Tanisha Anderson.
And similarly, she was in a mental health crisis. Her family members had called for assistance. As people often do when they're in a mental health crisis, they saw the police and felt threatened. And once they put her in a confined space in the police car, she had a reaction. And the police officers proceeded to take her down to the ground very hard, cracking her head on the ground, and killed her. And again, you know, Tanisha's family has been tireless in their advocacy and in demanding justice, and many community members of Black women and women of color in Cleveland and elsewhere have been tireless. But again, that is not a story, it's not a frame, it's not a lens through which we understand these issues more broadly, but hopefully that'll change now.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't mention her, but I want to mention her. Because this is a story I know, and one that got a lot of national attention, and that's Sandra Bland.
Yeah.
Who, when you see the full video from the dash cam of the police officer's car, she moves out of the way to get out of his way, and yet he pulls her over because she didn't put her signal on. And she says right there in the video, because he's asking, like, "You didn't put on a signal." Like, "I'm trying to get out of your way as fast as possible." And then she's arrested. A few days later, she's dead in her cell. And they say she hanged herself. How common is that? That people hang themselves in their cell? And how believable is that?
I don't think there's any data on how common or how frequently people hang themselves in their cells, so I can't tell you that. What I can tell you is that part of the reason Sandra Bland's story resonated so deeply with so many of us is because it incorporated so many elements of the problem. So, for instance, Sandra Bland was a case of driving while Black. It's something we've been talking about for decades, but we don't talk about as something that Black women necessarily mm-hmm. experience. But there it was, and there it was recently repeated with the state attorney general of Florida, a Black woman being pulled over in a similar foolishness, right? So that was one piece that resonated for a lot of Black women. And then similarly, as you were saying, she was following traffic laws. She was getting out of the way of an emergency vehicle. How many of us would forget to turn our turn signal on in that situation? How many of us forget to turn our turn signal on a daily basis? But driving while Black is a phenomenon in which that can lead to a stop and an arrest. And then, yes, it was also supremely common, and it's a pattern repeated throughout the book, is that whenever Black women sort of say, "Hey, treat me with dignity. Hey, don't disrespect me." And in her case, as you heard from the dash cam video, in a very calm way, police officers respond as if that's a threat that must be met with force and deadly force. And that was exactly what happened in that situation. There was physical violence. And then the other piece that was common about it, and that kind of should inform us going forward, is that she was being held, again, on a minor traffic violation, failing to use a turn signal. And then the officer piled on some charges to justify what he did to her in terms of beating her on a $500 bond that she couldn't pay. And so that is why she died. She died because the officer pulled her over. She died because the officer refused to just let her go with a ticket or a warning. As he should have. And then she died because money bail keeps people in who can't afford to pay their way out. And those are the themes and the elements, I think, coming out of that case that we need to take forward in our struggles in her name and in her honor.
And also there is a logistical thing in there. And correct me if I'm wrong. This happened on a Friday. And because of the weekend, like, you couldn't get a judge, you couldn't get anything. So she on top of the bun, there was nothing that she could do to not spend a weekend behind bars.
Right. And she repeatedly requested a bond hearing. She requested, you know, permission to call her family. She requested many things over the course of that weekend. It was consistently denied. And as her mother often points out, she was not the only Black woman to die in a cell that month. In fact, 5 Black women died in their cells in the same month of July 2015. And they were variations of being in jail, being held on bond for very minor offenses, some cases stealing food, some cases, you know, failing to use a turn signal, and then dying of some kind of neglect, medical neglect, being left in a cell for 3 days with no way of getting out, et cetera. And so I think that, again, sort of highlights from how one encounter with police can literally change the entire course of your life because of what happens once that system starts in motion.
Right. One case, and I mentioned her name in the introduction, where there was an encounter with police that didn't have deadly consequences, but it certainly had consequences for the nation, and I'm sure for this young woman, Dejeria Becton. She was the one who was at that pool party in Texas.
Yes.
Yes, and she was, you know, in a swimsuit, a 16-year-old girl who we watched on video being hurled to the ground like a rag doll by a police officer.
And if you look at the papers filed by the police officer in the lawsuit that she brought claiming violations of her civil rights, that was brought by my Howard Law School colleague. I'm very proud of both of them, obviously. His responses in the case say that he perceived her to be a threat as she was walking away from him in a bikini, because she called back to a friend saying, "Can you tell my mama that this officer told me to go to this corner so I won't be waiting on the corner where I told her I was going to be?" And he perceived that to be a threat, and that prompted the response that everyone saw on video. So I think, again, that case highlights a number of trends, one of which is that Black people, no matter how young, Black women particularly, no matter how young, no matter how elderly, no matter how disabled, no matter how in crisis, how in need of help, how what we're doing are perceived as a threat in similar ways and also in gendered ways to other members of Black communities. And then also that the presence of Black youth and Black women in particular in public spaces is perceived as a threat. And I think we tend to know that when it comes to young Black men like Mike Brown or like Eric Garner, we don't think about it when we think about young Black women like Dejeria Becton or Sandra Bland. And I think we need to start looking at, again, these issues through the lens of those experiences to better understand them, better understand how to tackle them, and make sure that we are fighting on behalf of all lives in Black communities.
You know, NBC Nightly News anchor Lester Holt, at the time of Freddie Gray, went down to Baltimore and interviewed a woman on her stoop. She was with her children, and she said something so poignant that I try to bring it up every time in having this discussion, especially after talking to about something that, like that Texas pool party where, you know, Black kids don't get to be kids. She said, how do you teach your children how to behave, how to act when they're doing nothing wrong?
Exactly. And I think that, you know, we often talk about the talk that Black parents have with children. And I often hear people talking about it, particularly with their young male children. And I'm sort of like, no, you have to have the talk with all your children of all genders and have a different talks based on different kinds of experiences. But yes, there is no way to say being at a pool with your friends when you've been invited, when you are an invited guest of people who live in an area, isn't going to subject you to Jim Crow policing tactics. There's just no way of warning someone against that. And that was not the only incident at a pool. There's another that unfortunately didn't make it into the book, involving a 12-year-old girl who came to a pool because she was wearing shorts and a t-shirt. They decided she didn't have appropriate attire, and the interaction escalated to the point where they had her over a police car and broke her jaw. And this, again, I mean, how do you say to a young woman, go to the pool and here are the things you can do to avoid that from happening? There is nothing. It's just, it's something that we need to prevent and address through the resistance that we are currently in, the policy changes and the conversations that we're having.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with police misconduct attorney Andrea J. Ritchie about her book, Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color. We'll be right back after a break. Jonathan Capehart sitting in today for Leonard Lopate, and I am with, or who's with me, Andrea J. Ritchie, author of Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color. Andrea, this book is not only a call for awareness, but the information in here is also personal. Talk about your interactions with the police.
I think I've been fortunate as a light-skinned Black woman to have few interactions with the police. The ones I've had, particularly as a younger person, were involved sexual harassment and in some cases sexual violence or imminent sexual violence or police officers when I was involved in a protest encampment at Cornell in the 80s around divestment from South Africa. The police officers who policed that encampment apparently had our photos on the wall in their sort of college precinct and often made comments, you know, sexual comments about us as protesters. So there's a variety, but I think the book is not so much about those experiences of mine as about kind of answering myself a little bit the question of why so many of us, you know, are leaders in movements around police violence, are active in movements around racial profiling, mass incarceration, mass deportation, and rarely talk about our own experiences or rarely find them centered in movements. And I think particularly that is true around police sexual violence. So, for instance, there's been quite a conversation since the killing of Mike Brown around fatal encounters, particularly with unarmed people. There are databases that the Washington Post or the Guardian or so on have created, but there's been less attention, for instance, to a database that the Buffalo News created in 2015 around police sexual violence. And their research found in this huge database of cases of police sexual violence that an officer had been caught in an act of sexual misconduct or assault every 5 days in the decade before the report came out. So between 2005 and 2015, a police officer had been caught in an act of sexual misconduct or assault every 5 days.
I mean, these are people who are sworn to protect us, who are sworn to uphold the law, and yet there are some who take that, you know, that oath to protect and the power that comes with that to commit crimes.
Indeed. And
but what happens, I mean, so we know this, but what happens to those officers?
Well, this data was only about those who were caught.
Right.
And the social science research, which is predominantly done actually by current or former law enforcement officers in this particular field, they will agree along with advocates that those kinds of numbers are just the tip of the iceberg. So what happens most often is nothing. To the extent that one officer may be terminated, they are free to go work at another agency. And I talk in the book about the research that shows that that is a systemic issue. And most often there aren't even policies. For instance, the New York City Police Department does not have an explicit policy saying that police cannot sexually harass or assault members of the public. By law, they must have one about sexual harassment and assault among employees. But there's no specific policy telling officers that they can't holler at young women walking down my block or proposition them and say, you know, if you do this for me, then I won't write you a ticket for disorderly conduct or worse. And because then there's no, then that creates a vacuum of detection, of prevention, and of accountability that allows this kind of thing to go on in a fairly systemic and widespread way.
Now, one of the things about this, one of the missions of this book is not only to make it clear that it's not just African-American men who are victims of police violence, but Black women, as we've talked about, are victims of police violence. But you also make a point of this book to make it clear that women of color, spanning the spectrum, are victims of police intimidation, police violence. You write about what's been happening to Native American women who were a Mohawk community was fighting to protect their land from a Canadian army in the 90s. I mean, there's a lot going on here. Talk about that, Native American women.
I really struggled when I was writing the book about not just keeping it to Black women, because Black women have a very unique experience of policing in this country that dates back to 1655, when Black women were first dragged in chains to this continent. And but also wanted to make that connection, wanted to say, look, you know, our experiences are unique, but they are also connected to those of Indigenous women who have also experienced police violence from the moment Christopher Columbus arrived on this continent. And I particularly this year, there was a lot of attention to Standing Rock. And last Saturday was sort of National Water Protectors Day to honor the water protectors at Standing Rock. And there was a tremendous amount of police violence against the Indigenous women on the front lines at Standing Rock. And for me, that was reminiscent to the incident that you described earlier that had been kind of one of my first moments of coming into awareness in Canada around the amount of police and state violence against Indigenous women to maintain, you know, who were fighting for their land as well. So it's a continuous arc from 1492 to the present in terms of violence against Indigenous women. Indigenous folks have the highest rates of police killings, have the highest rate of disproportion in terms of mass incarceration in this country, are very much, Native women are very much targeted in the war on drugs, and we never talk about that. And it felt like a duty to do that. We don't talk much about police violence against Latina women, a little bit in the context of immigration enforcement, but increasingly we're going to need to look at how the intersection of immigration enforcement and things like stop and frisk and broken windows policing are leading to police violence, police harassment, mass incarceration, and mass deportation of Latina women. And lastly, I would say, you know, we haven't talked much about how Islamophobia, starting from 9/11, the war on terror, to the virulent Islamophobia that we're living under right now, affects police interactions. And so there are some cases in the book that lift that up as something that, as we're examining these phenomena, as they intensify in the current political climate, we need to center the experiences of women in each of these communities to better understand them and better understand the connections among women's experiences.
Okay, well then, let's talk about specific women. Maya Hall?
Maya Hall is a black trans woman who was shot by National Security Agency officers in Baltimore just weeks before Freddie Gray was killed, and his death kind of rocked that community and the nation. And we hear much less about Maya Hall than we do about Freddie Gray. She made a wrong turn and was trying to get away, and instead of sort of being given the benefit of the doubt, was shot first and, you know, questions asked later.
She was trying to get away from whom?
She had made a wrong turn. I've made this wrong turn. Many people make this wrong turn. Maybe you have also. When you're on the Baltimore-Washington Expressway.
Oh, yeah.
There's a turn that you go to, it's for Fort Meade, and it takes you onto NSA property.
Oh, yes, yes.
She just made that turn, wrong turn. Saw where she was, saw people directing her to turn around and leave. Panicked,
I remember that case. Yes.
Panicked and was shot. That's tragic. And it's her black life, again, is one that is valuable to all of us, and that needs to be honored and lifted up in similar ways as Freddie Gray's and the lives of so many other black people who have been taken. Kayla Moore is another black trans woman whose story I tell in the book, who was also killed by police officers who were responding to a mental health crisis. These are stories that, that again, communities of black trans folks and family members of black trans folks are organizing around, are speaking out around, are demanding attention and action around, and the rest of us need to join those voices.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Andrea J. Ritchie about her book, Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color, and it's by Beacon Press. You were talking about trans women of color and their interactions with police, and there's something sort of specific to trans women that gets them into trouble when they come into contact with police. If syringes are found on them, police automatically assume that that's drugs.
Yeah, and I would say that there's something specific about police that gets black trans women in trouble with police, because, you know, black trans women more often than not are doing absolutely nothing when police officers approach them, perceive them to literally embody disorder. There's a case I describe in the book where a black trans person or a gender nonconforming person was literally just standing in the park, hanging out in the park, doing their thing, and the police walked up and gave them a ticket for disorderly conduct. I mean, that is so common. And then, of course, there's all kinds of violence and gender policing and violation that happen in the context of police interactions with trans folk. And yes, there is also, if you have a syringe on you and it's because you're a diabetic, no one is necessarily going to question that. But if you have a syringe on you and it's because you are administering hormones or some other gender-confirming treatment, suddenly, no one's going to believe. They're going to be like, no, you're using drugs, or this is drug paraphernalia. And that's a common experience for all members of black communities, right? Like, I mean, black communities carry a pen around and people think it's a crack pipe, right? Or police particularly will police it as a crack pipe. So I think this is just a gender-specific experience of having syringes for health reasons that then get translated into criminalizing perceptions of criminal activity based on police. So again, I think the problem is with the police, not with the person who's being targeted.
And then there's and then you have something about here when police come into contact with prostitutes and they find condoms on the prostitute, what do they do? And why is that a problem? Why is that a problem?
Well, I mean, so many reasons, right? It's literally the police reaching into the pockets of New Yorkers and people across the country and taking away the only kind of birth control you can get over the counter without a prescription, right? And or the only kind of protection you can have for STDs over the counter without a prescription. But also, it's about racially gendered profiling, right? It depends on who and where it happens. I think that, you know, on the Upper East Side, if you, you know, walk by the clubs on Second Avenue on any given night, you'll find many women attired in a particular way with many condoms in their purses, and they will be perceived as exercising the reproductive rights their mothers fought for and out on the town having a good time. Black and Latina women dressed in the exact same way, carrying condoms maybe in a different part of town or maybe even the same part of town, will be assumed to be and profiled and arrested and targeted as being engaged in prostitution-related offenses. And there's been a fantastic article in the Village Voice by Melissa Gira Grant and a lawsuit by the Legal Aid Society of New York talking about the degree of racial profiling that happens in that context. And I think that kind of thing we tend to think of as like a separate conversation. And that's not part of the larger conversation about stop and frisk in New York City or about broken windows policing in New York City. And part of another goal of the book is to say, no, that is about stop and frisk. That is about broken windows. When stop and frisk happens and condoms turn up instead of a small amount of weed, that's still very much part of the larger problem that we're talking about. When broken windows policing targets minor offenses, one of them is loitering for the purposes of prostitution, and that is leading to criminalization predominantly of Black and Latina women in New York City.
And speaking of criminalization of Black and Latina women in New York City, women on welfare, those women on welfare are targeted by police, you say.
Indeed, and I appreciated yesterday the guests you had on your show talking about the targeting of Black and Latina women also in the context of child welfare enforcement and the sort of the new Jane Crow, the sort of phenomenon that's being talked about most recently in the New York Times article back in on the 23rd of July. But I would say that this has been a longstanding problem that in the 1990s, and it's a longstanding problem that's part of the larger conversation on broken windows policing. So in the book, I talk about research that Dorothy Roberts, who's written extensively on the subject, quotes, where there was a threefold increase in the number of misdemeanor arrests for child welfare-related offenses in the 1990s under Giuliani, who said, as part of his broken windows policing theory, if we arrest Black moms or mothers for minor offenses, that will prevent larger or more serious child welfare offenses. So it meant that that mothers were being arrested for their kids playing outside the housing project or for minor things like you talked about yesterday where someone goes downstairs to get diapers,
formula, yeah.
Exactly, and then comes back upstairs and is being charged for neglect and abuse. That is rooted in broken windows policing. That needs to be part of the conversation around broken windows policing. And that is a long-standing trend that is getting more attention now, but also not only leads to arrest, it facilitates police violence because police officers threaten to take people's children away and threaten child welfare as a way of exercising power over women, as a way of extorting sex, for instance. And people don't think about the role police play in that child welfare enforcement that can lead to physical violence and, in some cases that I document in the book, deadly violence. So I think that the thing about the book is looking more closely where we're already looking. Let's look at stop and frisk numbers and look at what's happening for Black and Latina women. Let's look more closely at broken windows policing and see how enforcement of prostitution-related offenses or street vending offenses disproportionately impact Black and Latina and immigrant women. And then let's look where we're not looking. Let's look at child welfare enforcement and see what the role of police is in that situation and how it perpetuates racial profiling and how it's perpetuating police violence and criminalization. Let's look at police sexual violence. Let's look at what we can find out about how that plays out and who's targeted. And let's look at any number of other places, responses to violence, responses to calls for help, responses to mental health crises, and see what we can learn about the overall problems of racial profiling, police violence, mass incarceration through the experiences of women, trans and gender nonconforming people.
I have two questions I need to ask you. The shrinking clock that we have, we actually got a call from a police officer who called to say she's very glad that you're bringing up these issues, and particularly I think this was in response to mental health issues, police dealing with people with mental health issues. And she feels that cops definitely need training in mental health issues. But she's also concerned, this officer, that we acknowledge how many police officers are killed while on the job.
I think that in the context of responses to mental health crises, there's research cited in the book that shows, that posits that at least half of the instances of police killings of non-police officers involve someone in mental health crisis. And the recommendation that was made by the Ruderman Foundation is that if we just took police officers out of the equation entirely around how we respond to mental health crises, that would cut the number of police killings in half, meaning the police killing people who are not police officers. My guess is it would also result in a reduction in harm to police officers. I think that it's a win-win situation to say we're going to find a different way to respond to people with mental health crises than sending in people who are in uniform, who are armed, and who have a limited set of responses at their disposal that, what we know, often results in injury or death to the
person.
But
then, so if someone's in a mental health crisis and it's life or death, like it's really out of hand, if you don't call the police, who do you call? Or you call the police, but someone else, who's the someone else that deals with the person in the crisis?
An experienced mental health professional. And then I think also it's about thinking more preventatively. So, for instance, we're talking now about getting rid of health care for millions of people in this country when what we need is more access to mental health and other kinds of health care in this country, right? So making sure that we have mental health services available in our communities, and particularly in Black and low-income communities and communities of color, and affordably, will then prevent that situation, people from winding up in mental health crises. And then responding with mental health professionals, with supportive services, not with violence and restraint, is going to be more likely to produce a result that is better for all involved.
And, you know, I keep thinking as we're talking, and I was looking over the book, that a lot of these things had that you talk about, and a lot of the reforms you think should be in place, and the way we should be looking at these things, had support from the White House, from the Justice Department under the previous administration. Now that we have a Justice Department run by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who has made it clear that we're not going down this road anymore, how important is it to have the stamp, the imprimatur of the Justice Department to get forward movement on these things you think should be done?
I mean, it's not going to happen right now. So, I mean, I think what's important is for us to look at what the Justice Department is proposing to do when it comes to immigration enforcement, the war, ramping up the war on drugs, ramping up Islamophobic bans and enforcement, to make sure that we are looking at that from all angles, including the experiences of Black women and women of color, so that our resistance to what is happening is more effective and protects as many of us as possible.
The police officer who called before, thank you so much for listening, by the way. She called back to say that the LAPD has a great program involving police officers and mental health people, and that this is a model for dialogue. So hit the Google and find out what's, I'm saying that to everyone who's listening, to find out exactly what the LAPD is doing. I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate. I've been speaking with police misconduct attorney Andrea J. Ritchie about her book, Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color. Andrea, this time flew and we didn't even crack even half, a quarter of the book. But thank you so much for coming in.
It's been an honor and a privilege to be here. Thank you.